Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
I took the privilege of adjusting my title slightly because I switched it from account to approach. Because in one sense, this is, if you put it silly, this is in a certain sense, this is a plea for help. It's putting out a kind of a research project that I've been thinking about for a while that links in with these conferences, things like that. And I think, but it's in an interesting way kind of come to my mind just from various things that have come up over the course of today about, the value of being able to draw on people from so many different backgrounds. And I'll try to talk about that a little bit. That said, the talk itself is, in a certain sense, inspired by, I guess, a little bit of pet peeve about ways that Thomists sometimes are a bit too fast and loose, I would say, with aspects of how they talk about the philosophy of nature. And I don't want to say that there. So there's one person in particular that I'm going to be referring to, and he's a very, very good philosopher. And I don't want to say I don't want to disparage that, but I do think that he's, making a misstep. And a misstep, arguably along the lines of using principles from too high of a science to talk about something in a lower science. But the framing device for this is, from the title, How the Highest of the Inanimate Touches the Lowest of the Living, comes from this general principle Aquinas gets from Dionysius in the Commentary on the Divine Names. He says, talking about the order of creation, he mentioned that Dionysius, he adds that the mode of this order, he describes the mode of this order because it always joins the ends of first things, that is, the lowest of the supreme things, to the principles of the second things, that is, to the supreme of the lowest things. So this is one of these broad adages that Aquinas sort of throws out there here and there, but he takes it quite seriously. He really does try to kind of fill in all the gaps in the hierarchy of nature. So the picture here is, it's not from Aquinas, it's from a Raymond Lull diagram, but it's a kind of classic picture of the medieval Scala Natura, the hierarchy of being, sort of starts down here with rocks, earth, you get fire, you get plants, animals, humans, into the heavenly spheres, angels and God. There's, and roughly speaking, Aquinas accepts the fact that there is this. We can divide nature into these parts. We can separate these different genuses. But he has this principle where, in general, when you're looking at the edges, things are going to kind of come pretty darn close to each other, sometimes to the point of being a little bit fuzzy. Again, how fuzzy kind of depends on the edge. Probably the most clear and consistent edge he has, if there's any here, is the divide between the material and the spiritual. Which roughly follows what Dr. Gorman had mentioned about whether or not, I need to be a little careful here. But he has the general principle that spiritual realities can act on lower things in certain ways, but material things in no way can act on higher things. Now, there are certain Thomists who want to add other layers for various reasons and say that there are other barriers. And one of the ones is the argument that there is a kind of Thomistic argument that we can make based off of how we understand life right now that says there's no way that non-living things could become living, that it would require some kind of divine activity. So I want to present that argument very briefly, and I'll kind of come back to it a few times, or a version of that argument, and then argue two things. One, why Aquinas didn't accept it, and again, this scholar knows that, and I'll mention that as well. I need to be careful here because this is a slightly indulgent part of it because it is me spouting on weird things about Aquinas' understanding of natural philosophy, but there's a point I want to get across in doing that, so I'll try to be, it'll be brief, but trying to, in a certain sense, complexify, sort of show the depth of Aquinas' understanding or thought that went into his understanding of the philosophy of nature. Because sometimes we start to see things that are unfamiliar with us, and we sort of lump them into the kind of magic category or God category. And Aquinas has a God category. He also has a magic category. But not everything that is unfamiliar to us fits in there. And there are lots of things that are purely natural to him in a way that might be unfamiliar to us, but really are natural. And he is really looking for mechanisms in a certain sense, maybe not the kinds of mechanisms we're familiar with. And some of those mechanisms might draw on things that seem outdated, a kind of vitalist intuition about how nature might work in certain ways. But it's important to kind of understand him on his own grounds. So I'll try to argue for that and show that, in fact, what to many people seems to be this big gap between the inanimate and the animate, for Aquinas was really relatively small. And then I'll try to make an argument that we need to make the same effort, that there's a way we can think about the natural world where the inanimate world seems really, really far from the animate world. And I think Thomists sometimes tend to fall into that, and I think that's a little bit of the background behind this argument, and that there's work to be done among Thomists to fill out our picture of the inanimate world in order to be able to grapple with the questions that, you know, questions that are in some ways more pressing about life, and particularly human life and human nature. So that's the goal, so we'll start with just a brief presentation of a version of this Thomistic argument against life, already from Nine Life. And so this is from David Oderberg, who again, his book on real essentialism is very good. You know, I've got quibbles, but I have quibbles with everybody. But he makes the argument that, in a paper from a collected volume in 2013, the essence of life, I claim, is what Aristotelians and Thomists sometimes call immanent causation. And he is getting this from the broader scholastic tradition. It's not in it, like that phrase is not in Aquinas per se, but there are later Thomists that use that in different contexts. And he says this is causation that originates with an agent and terminates in that agent for the sake of its self-perfection. Hence, in immanent causation, the agent is both the cause and the effect of the action, and the cause itself is directed at the effect as perfective of the agent. Now, there's a lot good in that description or pieces and parts of that about things we would want to include in our understanding of life, the kinds of activity of life. But he wants to push this farther to say that there is a claim you can make for the defender of biogenesis, basically the impossibility of abiogenesis, the impossibility of living things coming out of inanimate matter, ought to make is to say that immanent causation can never arise in any way from transient causation. This is causation where one thing acts on another. So no amount of one thing acting on another will ever add up to immanent causation. And I mean arise in the diachronic sense, no amount of transient causation can ever over time give rise to immanent causation. There's a lot I could go into about the details of this argument and get into the Thomistic weeds, and I'm going to avoid that. And I'm going to just jump straight to what did Aquinas think about life, and does this characterize his understanding of life? And so, for Aquinas, what characterizes life is, as we heard, the notion of the soul. And there's a certain sense in which already we got to be careful about the worry about the divine, the spiritual, as Dr. Gorman mentioned. Soul, in this Aristotelian Thomistic context, just is a particular kind of substantial form. It's not the same kind of substantial form as a rock has, but it is a kind of substantial form, and it's a substantial form of a particular kind of body. It's the first act, which all substantial forms are, of an organized natural body. He does not need to add, so this is the second expression of this. The first one mentions having life potentially, which he then clarifies requires for a body to have life potentially, requires that it have organs. For Aquinas, inanimate bodies, rocks, water, metals, were completely homogeneous. Every part was qualitatively the same as every other part. It was rock all the way down. Living bodies have organs, parts that are qualitatively different from one another and ordered in such a way as to allow various complex activities of life by one organ acting on another. Now, that said, many of the organs are heterogeneous, so you could talk about the hand has lots of different parts to it, but he also thought that living bodies, too, were ultimately composed of heterogeneous parts. So flesh, bone, sinew, nerves, were nerve all the way down in a certain sense. So Aquinas also consistently argued that what distinguishes life is self-motion, which is possible, at least in part, because there is a qualitative difference in the heterogeneous parts, so that one part can move another. The way that natural bodies act for Aquinas is either by, you know, it reduces down the sort of standard natural motion, reduces down to the activity of the four elements, hot, cold, wet, and dry, the qualities of the four elements, hot, cold, wet, and dry. And so for one thing to act on something that's next to it, it either needs to be sort of moving and push into it and have enough density to cause to sort of violently move the thing out of the way, or there has to be a difference in quality. One thing is hotter than the other or colder than the other, and such that there will be some kind of activity, some kind of change of one part on another. A homogeneous inanimate body can only be moved or changed by something exterior in that case, because there is no difference in quality between the parts to allow for such a motion. So there is a certain sense in which Oderberg is touching on something that Aquinas does think. He does think that that inanimate objects are not capable of immanent causality, as Oderberg expresses it, and they're not capable of self-motion in the way that Aquinas expresses it, because there is just the homogeneity between them. Again, if something exterior acts on them, there can be motion through one inanimate object into another, but we'll leave it there. Now again, Oderberg argues that his immanent causation just is self-motion for Aquinas. I'm sure he's not right. So this is a point of contention in reading of Aquinas in various points. Basically, the sorts of things that often get linked to immanent causation for Aquinas, when he ever actually brings up examples, it is almost always things related to sensation, knowledge, willing. And he includes transient causation in certain contexts, gymnastics and using the body for things. So there are, I think there, the way Aquinas is dividing what is often linked to that, I think is a little bit off. But that's not the main reason that Aquinas would reject Oderberg's claim, because Aquinas believed in spontaneous generation and the heavenly spheres. Oh yeah. So we're not even in the question mark part here. We're in the like, this is just weird stuff. But I wanted to say a little bit about it to clarify that it's weird and it's unfamiliar, but it is natural for Aquinas. It's not something fundamentally spiritual. And I say that because Oderberg is aware that Aquinas talks about spontaneous generation. And his account for this, he's, in a certain sense, I'd argue he's aware that Aquinas disagrees. He's aware that Aquinas thinks and he's aware that Aquinas is wrong about this, but he doesn't know why. He has the wrong reason for thinking that Aquinas is wrong here, because he doesn't understand why Aquinas thinks spontaneous generation is reasonable and possible. So yes, so this is his account of Aquinas here. Yes, some living things, including animals, are produced naturally by seed, and others by decay under the influence of the heavenly bodies, and hence without seed. Aquinas believes in direct divine intervention at the origin, so the very beginning of creation and of life, but makes no suggestion that this intervention involved assembly, miraculous coming together of bits of inorganic matter to compose a living thing. Now, to his credit, I mean, he is trying to reduce a kind of presumption that Aquinas is just invoking miracle anytime something weird comes up. So he's trying to sort of avoid that. But he goes on to say that the continuing occurrence of spontaneous generation he attributes to God having initially imparted to inorganic matter the power to produce life, a property it continues to possess and to manifest under the right conditions. For Aquinas, then, a purely naturalistic explanation, whether of the origin of life or its subsequent emergence from the inorganic on other occasions, is out of the question. So, now, again, Oderberg is not wrong. Aquinas does attribute to God having imparted to inorganic matter certain sort of virtual powers that can be activated at times to in the service of life. He's getting There's the notion of rationes seminales from Augustine. But God also gave fire the power to burn, and rocks the power to go up and down, or to go down, sorry, and fire the power to go up. God gave all of the powers. God is active in all of the natural powers. So just because God gave that to it doesn't mean that it's not a natural explanation for Aquinas. And I think this is what we need to be careful with. So what, very briefly and probably too quickly, is Aquinas' account of how spontaneous generation works? More perfect animals require some specific power in the seed, either physical seed for plants, the seminal fluid for animals, to properly mix and arrange secondary matter, sort of some either earth or menstrual blood or something else going on, to be organized body of a specific kind. The moment the matter is properly transmuted, the corresponding soul form is educed from the potency of matter. Now, this might sound strange and is confusing in certain ways, but just this is not something special about animals and plants. This is how Aquinas thinks all substantial change happens. He rejects the idea that there is some exterior force giving form. He says that form is being educed out of matter. Aquinas tells nearly the same story, minus the seed, for any other natural substantial change, elements, mixtures, minerals, etc. The sun is involved as a universal cause in spontaneous generation and every other substantial change. No substantial change happens without the universal causality of the sun. And God and the angels are involved too. That hierarchy of being, it's all working. And that's part of his view of how nature works. But he has this notion that there are proper powers of the natural things themselves. In some changes, the other heavenly bodies are necessary. So there are powers he calls occult powers, which depend upon particular arrangement of heavenly bodies. This is how he thinks magnets work. This is how he thinks why gold cheers men's heart. But importantly, he has no account of like the proper arrangement of the heavens necessary for life. It's just the sun. It can have influences on dispositions of people, but it doesn't. You don't need the right astrological arrangement to make life happen. It's just the sun's there, it's always acting, and if the matter is arranged rightly, then the life will come to be. So imperfect animals then, those with that have an organized body that are so simple that they don't need this sort of specialized organization of the seed. Like to get all of the nerves and sinew and veins right in the human person, Aquinas thinks it takes a particular kind of special power to arrange the right kind of matter just in the right way. He thinks, gnats and flies and frogs are simple enough that they're simple enough that they don't need a whole lot of extra work to arrange matter that's already out there and available. Now, the activity of the sun here, though, is not some magic zapping of forms. It is giving heat and light. There's a twofold motion. It's sort of daily rotation, and then the annual drifting that causes the seasons. But the ultimate effect of the sun, this or that animal, depends not just on the fact the sun is acting, but also on the particular disposition of the matter. The sun doesn't know what it's doing. The sun doesn't choose to make this or that. The sun just acts on everything, and if the matter is disposed, the living thing comes to be. There are active and passive powers as well that play a role here and that has some complication here, but they're used instrumentally and as part of the conversation about the matter and the heat. For the sake of time, I'm going to just jump ahead. Aquinas is convinced that life can come from non-life because the lowest life is just not that far from non-life. Imperfect animals and plants have organized bodies, yes, but they are fairly simple bodies whose individual homogeneous organs don't really vary much from one another. I mean, like, how much stuff is there in a worm? More than you think. It does not take much for putrefying matter that just not too long ago was part of a living thing already, and is kind of already roughly in the range of where organs should be, to be the right kind and a little bit of extra variation and mixing from the motion and heat of the sun to end up with a properly arranged properly arranged to be the simple bodies of imperfect animals and plants. And so the point I want to get across here, he's using strange concepts, the activity of the heavenly spheres, something about these seminal powers. And yes, God is involved here, but God is involved in every human activity and every natural activity. There is something proper to nature and an explanation of spontaneous generation that is reasonable to him from nature. And there's more I could say, but we'll leave it there. So I present that just in part because a little bit self-indulgent of presenting the details of Aquinas' understanding, but because I found as a kind of methodological framework, it's really helpful to understand why Aquinas thinks what he does before we presume whether it's useful or not. And that there's actually some really subtle things that come out of digging into the details of weird things about the heavenly spheres, weird things about generation of animals. It's always those two. But that there are interesting principles you can draw from that that would actually maybe help you explain certain things in particle physics. There are interesting elements that come out of that that might give you context for thinking about kind of like the thermal dynamic systems of the Earth as we understand it. There's gaps there that we need to fill in, but there's not as much of a gap sometimes as you might think. So why do I think that a contemporary Thomist shouldn't agree with Oderberg? Again, Oderberg recognizes Aquinas, disagreed with him, but he said, well, he had bad physics, didn't understand it. We know better. Why does he think this? And I think a part of the argument, a part of this, again, he lays out in detail his own philosophical argument, but I'm thinking in terms of like a background presumption that comes out in some of what he has to say, is that in light of modern science, some Aristotelian Thomists have tended to default to there being inanimate substances primarily or only at the molecular and atomic scale. This comes out in different, very good scholars, but it's like, well, if we're looking for where there is unity in organization, then it seems like, the clearest unity in organization we found is at the level of maybe the atoms, maybe the molecules. And that's not a bad intuition per se, but in this view, inanimate substances are fundamentally heterogeneous. Like, what it is to be an inanimate substance involves different parts right next to each other, and also relatively simple. Like, I mean, a molecule is complicated, but not that complicated. It also means that the simplest life is also still fundamentally heterogeneous, but absurdly more complex. Like, the simplest cells, according to Google, have roughly 600 billion atoms. Right? So the jump from inanimate substances of, tens, maybe, if you're talking about certain certain molecules, you're getting up to tens and 20s and hundreds, to 600 billion is a big leap. And the idea of there just is this massive gap there. And there can be an intuition that there must be that gap is too big in a certain sense for us to make sense of, and so perhaps we need to invoke something else. Again, I don't know if that's exactly what, if that's the primary driving motion, I don't think it's the primary driving motivation for Oderberg, but I think it's in the background there. I'd also say this view is just hard to actually square with science anymore, particularly if you are leaning on what you remember from your high school chemistry class about atoms and molecules. Because as wonderful as these little pictures are, there are no spheres down there. There are no hard little balls. An alternative approach to this that some Thomists have argued for is to argue that, the right level at which to talk about substance in any context is going to be at least mesoscopic to macroscopic, that there's something about fundamental particles that is probably not substances. And to try and explain this, they, including me, often invoke this notion of virtually present, which Gorman mentioned briefly, which basically he says means not present, and he's not totally wrong there. Aquinas uses this term to argue for how the elements were present in a homogeneous mixed body. Again, I said iron was iron all the way down. it's a mixture of earth, air, fire, and water, but there's no bits of earth or bits of air or bits of water or bits of fire. It's a smooth, homogeneous mixture all the way down. So then how, in any sense, are the elements actually there if there's no earth, air, fire, and water to point at? And he argues that the four elements are just not actually present. There aren't the substantial form of the elements there, but that the mixed body itself has certain active and passive powers, which are, in a certain sense, derivative of and a certain medium of the extreme and most excellent active qualities of the elements. That every mixed body is kind of hot, a little bit cooling, a little bit dry, a little bit wet, and not as extreme as the elements are. And so it's a kind of averaging procedure. I think it might be a weird, like, two-dimensional square averaging thing, but that's a whole other thing. It's not uncommon for some contemporary atomists, myself included, to describe particles, atoms, molecules, and cells as being virtually present in macroscopic substances like metals, liquids, and human beings. This is a good, I think there's a good intuition here, but complex biochemical mechanisms are just not a blobby medium of the activity of, pick your element, quarks, electrons, atoms, molecules. You don't just average over the activity of all the quarks, and then you get what your protein is doing. And again, that's very, very clear for biological systems, but it's not even true for inanimate substances. Electrical conductivity of metals, the wetness of water, these aren't just the average activity of, you know, a blobby mess of quarks or atoms or anything like that. There is structure down there in some sense. We're pretty sure about that at this point. So how can we try to incorporate this notion of there being this sort of structure, this being this sort of hierarchy of pieces and parts, into a kind of attempt to talk about substances primarily being at the higher level? And I think a helpful tool here is actually to just embrace, in a qualified sense, Aquinas' notion of homogeneity. That at least it's at a first pass, I feel like this is a good step forward. And so as a first example, I'll start with the heavenly spheres. So imagine the nuclear plasma at the center of the sun. So this is this complex dynamic of primarily hydrogen and helium. Sun is a massive incandescent gas. Well, no, it's a plasma. But there's also the carbon nuclear, the carbon nitrogen oxygen cycle going on. But what I want to get across here is, okay, so we have, you know, we can sort of imagine the core of the core of the sun. We can sort of describe the process by which the set of nuclear reactions that lead from the combining of hydrogen atoms, or hydrogen nuclei, into helium nuclei. But this is where the particle physicist meeting clicks in. It's like, those little red balls, they're just like bags of quarks and gluons. Like, they're not balls at all. And they don't, like, the idea of talking about an edge of them is sort of, well, it's better than talking about the edge of the electron, but it's still kind of dubious. Also, to draw it this way and to presume that there's like, oh, so this happens, then that happens, then this next thing happens, then the other thing happens, quantum mechanics doesn't let you do that. There's going to be interference between the top and the bottom of that. There's going to be, we can talk about, oh, this hydrogen atom interacted with that hydrogen atom, but if you actually push that too far, you get the wrong answer. That this is a description and a model for something that is really happening, but is not something that can be reduced down to lots of little pieces doing individual things. This is, in fact, only really expressible as a kind of collective whole of the activity of the things shown there and other stuff too. You've got the nuclei there, and you have the products coming off the nuclei, but there also is this massive sea of electrons that have been stripped off of the hydrogens, which are helping to keep the energy going, and a massive sea of photons floating around that are helping to keep the energy at a high enough level to maintain, to prevent these things from breaking down into further structure. And so there's a certain sense in which this is both structured and yet very, in a certain sense, homogeneous. There's a certain sense in which any part of the stellar core is roughly the same as the other, and it's deeply dynamically homogeneous in the sense that if there is any variation, just what's going on there is very quickly going to wipe it away. Any attempt to build up larger structure than roughly the helium atoms and the helium nuclei and the nuclei of certain atoms is just going to get torn apart by everything else going on there. And so there's a kind of active dynamic homogeneity of, I would argue, any plasmas, particularly these, even more so getting into like quark gluon plasmas. There's a certain sense in which it's better to think of this as a holistic system that we can talk about pieces and parts at times, but if we push that too hard, the actual physics breaks down. So, example two, complete opposite direction. Solids. My recent favorite example, diamonds, because it's the one I just feel like I understand the best. But you could include metals, things like that here. There's a certain homogeneity here as well, but in a static mode, right? So a diamond is this particular way of binding together a bunch of carbon atoms. Technically speaking, you could say it's just one big carbon molecule. But we can see a picture here with lots of little black dots at very specific points, and then little like sticks holding it together. But that's not what's going on there. I mean, the picture in the middle here is better, that around each of those black dots is this distribution of electrons roughly into these four sp3 orbitals. And that's a better image of what's going on. Why do you get this tetrahedral shape? Because of the way that the electrons tend to organize around the carbon nuclei. But you gotta be careful here, because you talk to the quantum chemist and like, yeah, those things aren't real. There's no like little blob sitting next to it. That is a mathematical tool we use to describe this super dynamic complex activity of the electrons, of at least the carbon atoms, if not whole collections of carbon atoms. So arguably, there is a certain sense in which this stable static structure, you can talk of maybe like at least localize where the where each carbon atom is. Like once you know where sort of two of them are, presuming it's relatively regular, you can kind of figure out where the other ones are. But it's only held in that structure, in a very tight structure, because of this massively dynamic and, again, holistic and indistinguishable picture of what's going on with the electrons interacting with it. This mutuality between the more fixed nuclei and the electrons holding it into this broader structure. And to make sense of what the diamond does, the way it glistens in the light, you can't, we talk about, a photon interacting with an electron. Well, really, to get the right answer, you have to understand it's interacting with a whole collection of entangled electrons in a kind of holistic fashion. Okay, those are the two I'm most comfortable with, and now it gets messy. Because if we're trying to kind of, that's sort of two extremes of that are arguably homogeneous in different ways. One much more dynamic, the other one more static, where again, any kind of influence on the diamond or on this chemical structure is going to be distributed throughout and sort of maintain that structure in a certain way. Then we get into a kind of odd intermediate homogeneity of water, where there are, again, like the plasma in a certain sense, there is this massive dynamic system going on, and yet the parts have more structure to them, that the water molecules have different kinds of parts that are actually holding themselves together, and a kind of the arrangement of those parts is hugely important for what a water molecule is. To get the kind of polarization that water molecules have, which make them useful for instance, figuring out the difference in the magnetic field around a particular moon, requires them to have the parts to have a kind of relatively stable structure. And I say relatively, because again, it's not uncommon to model or talk about water molecules as just a bunch of fixed H2O molecules. So like in the picture of a simulation of liquid water. But in fact, there is this constant dynamism between water self-ionizing, and then you start adding other things in, and it ionizes all over the place. So there is small-scale structure, and yet there is more structure than you would talk about maybe in the plasma level, but there is still this like dynamism of what's going on in variation. As you move up into talking about solutions, so now we start throwing stuff together, you start getting this sort of structured homogeneity of solutions, where, again, the water organizes itself around the other things that are in there, and there's a back and forth between them. And again, you know, we can model that and talk about that in different ways, but there's sort of more structure that comes out of the water, and in a certain sense, more in different activities that it can have, depending on exactly what kinds of things are put into it in solution. And so it sort of changes the dynamics of the whole in a way that depends upon this mutual interaction between the parts. And then we can get into something even more structured. So this is a colloid. This is a model of milk. What you have there is a milk. What's it? The milky globule? Something. I should know this. But it's one of these bilipid layers with fat inside. There's also proteins mixed in it as well. Now again, this is something that is derived from life. Yes, but I would argue most people would say that milk is not alive. What is it? What should a Thomistic account of milk be? How should we think about this? And how should we think about this particularly structured level of almost inhomogeneity that's popping in? Are these individual things now that are individual substances mixed into the milk that perhaps in a way we don't, or mixed into the water, perhaps in a way we don't want to say that like just the sodium item is an individual thing? What are some principles by which we might, and this is, again, intentionally pushed in the direction of water, headed towards the kinds of systems that start to get towards what you would have for arguments for abiogenesis. But I feel like if it's on the Thomists to fill out their picture of the inanimate world, to talk about what this structure means in a kind of hylomorphic sense. And I think there's some principles that we can draw on. And I would argue, again, this is the particle physics coming out. Some of these are just sort of good principles to remember in any kind of science. Constant vigilance against hard little balls. There just aren't hard little balls down to the lowest layer. They weirdly pop up in chemistry and biology, and they're really useful to think of, but like we have to be a little bit careful about that. And there's a certain sense, I would argue, that sort of quantum mechanical uncertainty and entanglement are signs of the fact that we might not be talking about substances. Am I talking about things that are below the level of unity and organization that we would talk about as being substances? The lack of individuality, the holistic activity. There's a certain sense in which that's a sign of the fact that we shouldn't be surprised that unity is really properly is attributed to larger structures than just the individual particles. The other thing that Thomas has to learn is there just are no absolute elements. At least we don't know what it is yet. Aquinas just thought he knew what the elements were and could start at the bottom and work his way up. We can't. We have to work our way down. And that leads to a kind of structured elementarity, if that's a word, that you can talk about things that are sort of elements at a certain level and yet themselves are composed of elements. And it might be useful and important to talk about, you know, certain molecules as being elements in a certain context, certain atoms as being elements in a certain context, but a recognition that all of these things are building their way down. There's also, now here, what is the kind of language that the Thomist should be using? And here I'm intentionally kind of leaning into the Thomist language just because it's the part that hasn't been pushed as much. There's this notion of, in a Thomistic context of an integral part. Basically, that's like my eye. My eye is like right here. It stays in the same place with respect to my skull. If it doesn't, that's really bad for me. It's not a substance, but it is integral to being myself as a substance. It only properly makes sense as part of me, and yet we can point to it and localize it, and it does things in the same place at the same time. There's a certain sense in which we might look to localizability in a certain sense. We need to be a little bit careful here. As a sign of a kind of actuality, integrality of a part, either sort of temporarily or permanently, that perhaps we could talk about the nuclei in the carbon molecule as being actualized in a particular way, that the other part, like the electrons, aren't, and maybe something can be actualized temporarily. So when a particular neutrino smacks a particular water molecule in a mine in Japan. Then we could, like, it's actualized in a certain way for a moment and then is sort of goes back into being part of the whole. And virtual parts, in a certain sense, need to be we need to flesh out that notion a lot more. And this is super speculative, but in an odd way, I think that maybe the physicists got it right. And we can like learn something from the notion of virtual particles in quantum field theory. Side story to get there, but it's the idea that there are, we can talk about particles that are, they'll distinguish between virtual particles and real particles and draw in a certain kind of system. The virtual particle, in a certain sense, is the sort of thing that you don't expect to actually run into on its own, but is necessary to connect the things that you do expect to run into. And so it's part of the process, but quantum mechanically speaking, kind of shouldn't be there and doesn't really act on its own and never sort of escapes the diagram until you get to the real particle. That's a little bit fast and loose there, but this idea that virtual parts are imperfectly or just completely non-localizable principles of causal mediation, that they are in some sense constituents and at some times even perhaps actualized constituents, but often just the principles by which the whole acts this way or that way. And that we can at times quantify that activity in particular ways, but maybe not always in a way that localizes where and when exactly this part is doing that. But that to understand the activity, we can't ignore that there are these virtual parts there in some sense. And this perhaps some sort of gradation between virtuality and actuality. I would say there's something different about the actuality that you find in the protein channel of life than the actuality you would find even in the nuclei of the atom or the nuclei of the carbon atom. So as a kind of connecting back to the beginning, I think this higher tower of understanding of the inanimate also opens up to a tool for distinguishing, like connecting but also distinguishing what is so just weird and interesting about the inanimate or about the animate world, that it's not just an arrangement of actual pieces. So it's not like I went into an erector set, stuck them together, and got my Cartesian machine of a cell running, but it is actually actualizing things. It is actively actualizing structures that in a non-living context are often not actualized, that they're part of, but more virtual. So that the lipids are constantly interacting with one another because of the size and structure they have, because they're around such a diversity of different kinds of molecules, that again, the kind of, from a quantum mechanics perspective, the indistinguishability does, you know, it falls away because you have different kinds. And so that these are actual integral parts in a real sense at the cellular level. And that these actually integral parts have this, because of the specificity of their structure and organization, can actualize more stuff than you use and more consistently than you would find in inanimate matter. That you can actualize these potassium ions, these hydrogen ions in protein transport, and this mutual dependence of the function of the actualized part and the control of the interior environment in this relative independence from its surrounding is a kind of self-actualization, and that is in a certain sense caused by and continued by constant self-motion of one part on another because of the diversity of one part next to another. So there's a certain step from homogeneity through a kind of inanimate homogeneity to a kind of organized, not just like diverse, but like specifically diverse in order to certain kinds of activities and functions. Can these steps be transversed by nature alone? I don't think there's a Thomistic principle that would tell you yes or no. I think that's an empirical question about just how complicated are these actualized systems of life. So again, this is not intended to be a complete set of answers. I'm sort of more convinced about the first two, and then it starts to get fuzzy in some ways as a kind of starting point. But the hope is, the set of questions, the research program perhaps, is can we be carefully and sophisticated realist about the sciences and the inanimate world of chemistry in a way that incorporates our knowledge of, but does not sort of naively privilege the smallest and the most remote. Again, this is an extension of certain efforts made by 20th century scholars and more recent Thomists, but in a certain sense, sort of to really focus on chemistry. Again, usually the biological questions because of evolution, or quantum mechanics because it's weird, or the Big Bang because it's the beginning of the world, but like nobody talks about just like tabletop chemistry, or no, Thomists don't talk about tabletop chemistry. And it's sort of like the low-hanging fruit that we haven't bothered to work on. So is this the sort of interdisciplinary, it's also the sort of interdisciplinary work that I'm absolutely convinced Thomists can't do alone. We need help. We need help from people who understand the science much better than we do, from the range of sciences to cover the entire scope. And it's going to require bridging existing sciences. And the work, in a certain sense, falls on the Thomist. But I think for the Thomist to be able to offer good philosophy to the scientist, I think we need to learn more science to understand our own philosophy better. So as a way of bridging what are these sort of existing divisions in the sciences. Wait, what's that little line there? Oh, even if we're all really doing the same science in the end. Oh, not Mariah, but everybody else. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.